All right. Okay. The primary sources for a lot of the conclusions that I'm drawing in this speech come from 5 years of help desk experience dealing with users of all intelligence and experience levels, and 6 months of dedicated standard usability testing of ideas that me and my fellow developers came up with for a shell replacement kiosk development package. First question, who is the bigger threat to your IT department? Trust me, it gets worse. The elite hacksaw. He knows where you live. He knows header files. Yes, he is elite. He cried when attrition.org stopped updating their defacement mirror. And he has never used plain English when communicating with any of his friends. Even over the telephone, believe it or not. And now we have Ms. I think my computer hates me. I told you it got worse. She's a frequent visitor to buddyicons.com. She has a system tray in Windows NT longer than her hair. She actually thought Clippy was sexually harassing her the first time that he came up. You know, he's all cute, you know, he popped up, had that little wink, you know. And ironically was recently promoted from billing to help desk supervisor. This is my life. The fact of the matter is that they're both a threat. I was actually supposed to ask which one of you thought was more of a threat, but screw it, they're both a threat. The fact of the matter is that all users are only humans. Humans are fallible beings. Humans have reactions to stimuli that, regardless of how simple or how complex or how threatening that stimuli, their reactions to it are often guided by instincts and limited information, prejudices that they come to pretty quickly. And as humans, they're prone to follow behavior patterns that they're familiar with. Once they get into a set established pattern, they're more set to regress right back to that than to try something new or then to grow. I mean, we're only human, we all do that. Poor interface design puts the user in position to compromise systems indirectly by either screwing up their security settings or by being deceived by someone who's trying to intrude the system through the user. First, I wanted to talk about, I have basically two big items that I wanted to hit on. Users are often betrayed in security by their own sense of paranoia or by their own comfort level and comfort zone. Probably the most disturbing single thing are pop-up events that happen such as this. In any kind of usability testing, we've always found that these kind of pop-up events, you know, regardless of how benign, regardless of how simple or how complex they are usually the single most jarring thing for a user. That even though it's a course of daily life in virtually every interface, it's still jarring for users to be presented from their plane of vision into something that just pops up right in front of them. I mean, it's a natural instinct. If you're just sitting there and someone pops up right in front of you, you're going to be scared. Humans, while they don't have the same reaction to pop-up windows because they're more used to it, are still on a subconscious level threatened and heightened into a slight state of alert by pop-up messages. Another common thing that we found was no exit opportunity events. You know, when a page has poor code and your poor browser's trying to debug it, you have to go through screen after screen after screen after screen after screen after screen of these, you know, standard little pop-up messages. There are a lot of other type of no exit opportunity events, things such as bombardments, you know, when you type one key wrong, when you're entering in the URL, boom, you know, you pop up and you're suddenly bombarded with 50 windows and things like that. The other thing that is exploited or that can be used to exploit users through their own paranoia are confusing security levels, inappropriate metaphors for security settings, clustering security that should not be clustered, and all of this causes frustration that leads to exploitable user paranoia through no fault of the user's own directly, even though the user more often than not is stupid. Of course, being DEF CON, I have to diss on Windows. And I mean, legitimately, the security options, internet settings in all of the new Windows flavors are extraordinarily complex. They are far, far, far beyond most people's knowledge about system security. Even if you know general basic security user paradigms, if you're an educated user, a lot of the options presented in these menus can be very confusing and can be threatening. The other really big disadvantage to what Windows does is that it sets supposedly custom security levels, you know, high, medium, low, and, you know, completely fucked. I'll take questions at the end if that's all right. It's a very, very poor security model. And more often than not, users have different needs. Users need to access different sites. Users need to use the internet in many different ways. And they need to set up different security paradigms for what they're going to be doing. And this is one way, just by confusion, that the user becomes paranoid, and it creates a weakness in the system that's user-based. Of course, and the most obvious one is, I think I lost my place here, I'm sorry. Right, just going back into what I was saying. Paranoid users will often interpret security information incorrectly and revert to insecure behavior because they draw analogies out of network technologies from things in real life. One actually somewhat common one in the environment that I was working with were professors who were under the impression, professors were under the somewhat correct impression that digital cell phones are usually less prone to casual eavesdropping than party lines, than PBXs, than, you know, things in your office. You're probably, if you want to make a private call, you're probably better off taking your cell phone outside than risking someone else in the house picking up the phone, casually eavesdropping it, or having the line tapped, things like that. We've all heard those stories. So these professors think that because digital cell phones are more secure than generally wired phones, they think that wireless networks, of course, have to be more secure than wired networks. I mean, I'm not kidding. People actually think this, and that's one way that user paranoia can be exploited, by drawing and reaffirming incorrect analogies such as that. Paranoid users, like I said, will also seek familiar escape routes out of visual or oral bombardments. When they're presented with a lot of pop-up windows like that, if you can design interfaces that exploit the user's own patterns and own tendencies to try to escape those things, you can, of course, implant Trojans, you can penetrate security, you can get to things that you're not supposed to be getting to, and of course you're going to get to them because the user's trying to escape. They're not trying to keep their system secure, they're not trying to understand what's going on, they're just simply trying to get out. And you can install a lot of things by presenting another bombardment and leaving nice little simple, okay, and, you know, just install a whole host of stuff through a visual bombardment like that. Paranoid users, ironically, and what we found in some of our usability testing, are prompted to shut off security warnings. And, of course, being paranoid users, they fail to follow up on passive security indicators. They think that simply because there's nothing telling them that something's wrong. I mean, they remember that they shut off some things, but they still expect the computer to tell them if something's gravely wrong. And, of course, the computer's not going to tell them that there's anything gravely wrong because the computer's a computer. You told it not to do something, odds are it's not going to do something. And so that's another way that a user's own paranoia can be used to betray them, to compromise security. And also, paranoid users, like I said before, trust familiar visual clues. Another common way of exploiting things is just by saying, you know, install this free security update, or you need this security update, or you need X, Y, or Z. If you can present an interface that's familiar enough to them, that's another way that you can compromise user security. Of course, the flip side of that is exploiting the user through user comfort and sources of false positive information. One quick example of this is relying on the preponderance of visual cues. Security alerts like these are kind of, you know, half and half. More often than not, yeah, it's fine. That, you know, Microsoft for some reason has decided not to list that issuer of security certificates. But the way that the average user reads this is very similar to the way that the average user will read a newspaper or will read a magazine. The first thing that they'll see is that big icon that's on top of the big white space towards the left. That's the first thing that draws their eye in. That sets the user into a state of panic. You know, it's yellow, it's a warning there. And then the average user will go down there, and the iconography will register in the user's conscious before they read any text. They'll see, you know, okay, there's a smaller warning icon there. But, oh, wait, my eye's drifting down below. After that initial smaller warning, I see two green things, so everything must be okay. You know, even if the user does read the text, and even if the user is not confused by the text, odds are, just because of the way that the iconography there is laid out, the user is more apt on a subconscious level to just say, okay, especially with the line at the bottom saying, do you want to proceed? Of course, the user's trying to do something. This is just another hindrance. Oh, it's trying to tell me something. Oh, but okay, I guess it's okay as they read down. And even though the default option on that window is no, more often than not, even with educated users, they're going to click yes. And like I said before, comfortable users, people who have a certain comfort zone about things, will follow patterns of usage that are routine or are diversionary. You know, one of the most common ways that users can be exploited by their own sense of routine or familiarity is through friends and family viruses and email and things like that. You know, Melissa, I love you and stuff like that. And actually, there's one particularly nasty friends and family virus that actually employs no code. It's actually a hoax. It's basically a message that people forward to each other, just like, you know, the good times virus and things like that, only this one implores the user to take action to find a specific file. In this case, it was a file that was a utility that restores long file names in Windows. And the host, you know, the hoax, used that system of trust networks that people have in forwards and in email, and it's, you know, extraordinarily common, a very common behavior pattern on the net, to exploit the more comfortable user. Ironically, this kind of behavior also works on the more paranoid user, because when you present a paranoid user with any kind of warning, and at the same time present the user with a call to action, more often than not, the paranoid user is going to immediately flow to that call of action, regardless of what it is, because that's what they think the best course of action is right there. It's just like, you know, when somebody says, oh my God, he has a gun, what's your first course of action? Duck. You know, regardless of where the gun is, the first thing that you're told, or the first thing that you've seen other people do that you've seen in movies, is the first thing you're going to do. The first thing that you're presented with in an email like that is, odds are, what you're going to do. And of course, another very common thing in help desks with lots of secretaries who like cute things are cute little Trojan applications. These are lovely. I mean, let's go back to Ms. I think my computer hates me. Okay, she has tons and tons and tons of these cute little applications that occasionally will have, you know, a little nasty Trojan that'll wipe out her computer and every computer on her subnet and all these things like that. And then, of course, we have to deal with it. I'm not bitter. So, because I don't have the kiosk package to present to you, I'm just going to jump right into the 5 points that I'm presenting that I believe can both not only increase the security of the interface, but also increase the usability of the interface. The first precept that I'm going to present here is actively using intelligent agents, things that are similar to IDS, in the background to predict user behavior, to record user behavior, to route around problems, and to automatically readjust security parameters based on what the user does and does not do. One of the first subpoints of this precept is avoiding intelligent agents in the foreground. You know, let's go back to pop-up menus and things like that. You know, users hate that. And, you know, even though I made a joke about this initially, in one help desk job that I was working at, there was actually a secretary who went through and actually made it through the whole way of the sexual harassment standard procedures complaint thing because of Clippy. Of course, it ended at the help desk, it ended at a trouble ticket, and of course, the nicest, most sympathetic guy who was working at the help desk had to calm her down because she was so traumatized by this little paperclip that appeared in the lower right-hand corner of her screen and winked at her. Honestly, these people have nothing better to do. And of course, the the best thing that you can do is predict and adapt to suspicious behavior. I actually got clearance to tell you one of the things that we were going to implement in the kiosk system that we never actually ended up implementing. The bombardment attack, like I was pointing out earlier, pop-up windows and things like that, what we were trying to do was map that behavior pattern. And before those windows got a chance to propagate all over the workspace, what we wanted our kiosk application to do was to automatically dock all of them at the bottom. And then after all of the pop-up windows had, you know, come to the surface and they were docked at the bottom, what we wanted to do was write an intelligent agent that would figure out if any of those boxes were actually needed to gain further access to the site. And then, of course, give the user the option of either browsing through all those pop-up windows to find what they wanted, or, more often than not, the user just simply wanted to get rid of them. And that's the kind of things that we can do with intelligent agents now. I mean, we didn't end up implementing that, but, you know, we were a small development team. It's not at all in any way, shape, or form beyond the scope of any kind of professional development team to develop intelligent agents to predict that kind of common jarring behavior that leads to insecurity for users on the internet and route around that. The second point actually comes from a paper in the that was presented in a journal of the Association for Computing Machinery. The paper is called The Anti-Mac Interface, and one of the big points they made was don't hand controls to the user when they're not in a position to be in control. You know, it's okay to have the little five-year-old come into the cockpit and see everything like that. It's okay even for an older person interested in aviation to, you know, hold the controls of a plane for a second like that. But you don't want Joe Novice on the street, you know, flying your flight out of L.A. to wherever you're going. You know, you want an experienced pilot who knows exactly what they're doing flying that plane. And it's the same sort of thing for users. You don't want to give them controls when far and away they're not qualified to handle the kind of responsibility that that control invests in them. Second point of that is don't give the user any information they can't use. If you have an intelligent agent application system set up beforehand, what you really want to do is to try to send this information into some kind of log file, into a place where it can be examined, send it to network administrators if you're running a series of kiosks, or at least bury the information in some kind of log where you don't give the user the opportunity to act on any of that information, where they can look at it, they can see it, and if they know exactly what they're doing, they can fix and predict and adapt to that behavior, but you don't give them a dialog box with the choice yes, no, or cancel. This actually leads to another one of my funny little help desk stories. Our network admin changed all of our keys for SSH on all of our login pool servers. And unfortunately, he forgot to send out the customary email the week before saying, oh, hi, the keys have changed. You know, your SSH clients are going to say your keys have changed to this. Just click yes and continue going on and on and on. So this came up all over in our department. We got a couple of calls about it. And when we were looking at the servers later, we found that a lot of users who we had told to use SSH because it was more secure would look at this and panic and think, oh my God, SSH is, you know, insecure. And what would they do? They would open up Telnet. And on, and like I said before, because that's a familiar behavior pattern to them. You know, because we said SSH was more secure, it didn't necessarily register in the user's mind that Telnet was insecure. And that's what they had used before SSH, so that's immediately what they went back to when they perceived SSH to be compromised. And of course it wasn't, but in any case. And the last, or second to last precept of this is, in kiosk and office applications, the interface should not accept new software from the user. Of course, this is most often in commercial applications not possible, but in office applications and in places where you can restrict things like that, where you do have a cohesive policy that says, you know, don't download cute little sheep, this is the more active course, this is the better course of action to do. And you can have kiosks out there that know exactly what software they may need in situations, reprogram them occasionally, say, okay, new software is coming out, you can download this, and not have to take up so much room on the kiosks if, you know, you don't have that room. But the trade-off to this is that, and this is the, again, enabling usability point, afford conveniences to the user that make them feel in control. Give them more powerful controls than they have now to manipulate the objects that they need to manipulate in their environment but don't give them the tools to manipulate the environment itself. You know, what makes you feel like you have more control over a car? You know, a responsive stick, responsive steering, responsive gas and brake pedals, or the ability to reroute the oil into the gas if you need to. You know, I mean, control about a, I mean, when you're using the car analogy, control about a car is all about how you use it to get the work you need done, done. And if it's responsive and if it's active and if it's using the agents that, you know, we're trying to describe and trying to develop, then it will actually become more usable and at the same time more secure. And the other thing is, please don't build your interfaces like brick houses. Make it as modular as you want, but be sure that the bricks don't fall out too easily. I'm sure that anybody who's written a lot of papers in Word has at one point or another accidentally dragged the menu bar out of where it's supposed to be. And as in another paper I quoted, there is absolutely no reason that most users would want this functionality. Okay, maybe there are a few crazy freehand and quirk heads out there who think that that's cool, but far and away, that's a quote-unquote feature that more often than not leads to a less usable operating system. I mean, most of the people in the room know, okay, you drag something out of it, you know, drag it back and it'll be fine, but like I said, the average user out there in the world, that'll happen to them, they'll think that they've broke something. I've actually gone on help desk calls where people said, I broke Word, it doesn't look the same, windows are popping up everywhere. And then they were incredibly amazed. I mean, they thought we were all magicians, simply because we went over there, we clicked on it, we moved it back to where it's supposed to be, and that's where it popped up. Like I said, I'm not bitter. The third out of the 5 points is design interfaces that function far more like a workshop or a playground and less like an office. And I so wish I could show you the kiosk that we were doing, but instead you're going to have to deal with lame examples. Avoid metaphors that don't translate well into real life. The magnifying glass example is one metaphor that translates very well into real life. You know, people go into graphical applications, they see, oh, there's this magnifying glass here. I'm sure that it will either let me zoom in or zoom out of wherever this picture is. You know, zooming out is a little bit more complicated of a feature, but that's a kind of functionality that translates directly into a real life world. For the life of me now, I still can't figure out why they called cookies cookies. I mean, I know why, but, you know, you, like I said, you're working at a help desk. You have a paranoid user. You know, honestly, once any of these ladies downloaded a cute little sheep and got a virus, they automatically went back in their security settings, said everything is paranoid, and so every day when they wanted to log into any system, they were so happy because they got to receive cookies all day. I mean, they were happier than that. I mean, that's, users are dumb. You have to present better metaphors or simply don't use metaphors at all when you're designing things like that. Develop reactive interfaces that encourage play and that are receptive to new interface technologies. We're still stuck in the WIMP paradigm, you know, Windows, icons, menus, pointer. It's for people who have never, ever, ever used it, it's counterintuitive. And the only reason it caught on was because there was a critical mass of people out there who could help other people, you know, understand the paradigm. And it's really not that hard of a paradigm to learn, but as far as interfaces go, it's not as robust as it could be. I gotta find out where it was here. One thing that a friend of mine and I were playing with in the cave, where I go to school, but I can't tell you where that is. It's a little school in southeast Michigan. You might have heard of it. They have a really big football stadium. One of the things that we were playing with in the cave was trying to develop a three-dimensional file system. And we had picked on some work that was being done in Berkeley in Germany about people who were using the tree as a paradigm for file systems. And it's really not that different from nested folders that we have in virtually every operating system today. Only the different thing about it was that every single file you could assign a different attribute to. And depending on what you needed to do and depending on how you needed to organize your files, you could arrange things in a tree and branch structure. Every file that was similar but part of a separate thread of a project would be arranged in that way in 3D space, and you could manipulate it. And the really cool thing that they actually ended up getting to work, it doesn't really have a practical application now because we can't all walk around in caves, was the ability to break off a branch off of your tree and hand it to someone else. And based on those same attributes and based on the attributes that the user on the other end, the user you were handing it to, had it set up, they would accept it. They would put it on their tree, and automatically that branch would configure to the way that they had everything there set up. Maybe they had the same project organized in a little bit different of a way. Based on the attributes in that file, they could re-relate their whole three-dimensional file system architecture to be responsive to them and do what they wanted. And that's this whole sort of thing. There are amazing new interface technologies that are coming out that people can use, but that aren't being implemented into operating systems because there's simply no way to put them into the WIMP paradigm. And like I said before, that leads to a lower degree of usability and a lower, in many ways, a lower degree of security. If you give the user more time to play with things in the interface, they spend less time screwing around with security settings and sending me to their houses at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not bitter. The fourth one is use more subtle cues to convey varying levels of security information. I know these are kind of bad examples, but things like color, contrast, and sound you can use to communicate security paradigms and security levels and things like that much, much, much more efficiently than normal. Then you knew that it was secure to do even more things. Enter in credit card numbers, enter in personal information, check transcripts and things like that, things of that nature. I mean, we don't have all the answers, and the guidelines that I'm presenting here are, I'm just throwing out there. I mean, a lot of people accuse user interface design of being a big old crapshoot, and they're not necessarily that wrong. You know, we invent these paradigms, and we throw them out there for use. And what I'm trying to do is, near Toronto, had simply unplugged the back of the box, plugged it back in, set Windows NT to VGA mode, boom, and then they had everything. It's just an incredibly stupid setup. But anyway. And the other thing that you want to look at, and this also can be done with not a tremendous level of intelligent filtering, is determining whether or not commands being issued by things operating on the interface level to determine whether or not they're actually coming from the user or a sub-process that it's really hard to integrate that kind of technology into a usable way, into a way that actually will catch on and achieve critical mass. And that's why we need new interfaces and new interface paradigms. We need to start at the drawing board and figure out new ways to use these new input technologies in our everyday lives. And even simple interfaces, you know, WIMP paradigm interfaces, even with complex agents, should be applicable everywhere a digital interface is desirable. Everything from palm units to cell phones to massive desktop workstations and servers. Simple interface paradigms apply everywhere, and you can use the same visual and subtextual cues on a Palm Pilot as you use on sophisticated workstations and servers. And that's the thing about paradigms, and that's the thing about other things. The WIMP paradigm is extremely portable. You do see it everywhere. You do see the same kind of menu classifications, and you do see the same kind of standard operating routes for users, no matter what digital application you're using. And by using simple interfaces with complex agents, not only are we enhancing usability, but we're also enhancing security, which is becoming increasingly important. You know, has anybody studied the WAP protocol? How many people think it's secure? Do you see any hands? No, I don't see any hands. Exactly. That's pretty much all I have. I just wanted to give a lot of thanks to these five people who helped me in a very difficult situation last night. We had a couple of productive conversations. Right, but that's, I mean, the user basically was making the point that a lot of people, and actually, he was making the point that we don't have educated people working at help desk. We don't have educated people working on helplines, and that's true. Some of the dumbest computer people I ever met were working in the help desk. I kid you not. I swear to God, I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter, but in every single help desk job I've had, I have never received an hour of official training. The only reason I knew all this is because I, like most of the rest of the people in the audience, went home and loved to break like his own computers and his mom's and his dad's computers at the same time, and that's how we learned. But that's not how we should learn. I mean, in designing user interfaces, you should have room for play. You should have room to make mistakes. You should have things where mistakes are sometimes rewarded, where creative thinking is not necessarily detrimental to the security of the system or the usability of the system. And that's what I'm advocating. I'm advocating that there are much, that with these 5 points, you know, we can try to start over a little bit. And by using subtextual cues and by using intelligent agents and things like that, and by, you know, starting from the ground up, by thinking, okay, we're at the beginning. Right, no, exactly. Secretaries are wonderful people. Every time that they had some kind of kernel 32.dll error, they would really, really helpfully write down every single memory register. You know, they would bother scrolling down, you know, write all this stuff down, you know, take it down and we record everything and expect us to know what the hell it was. I can't read memory registers. If I could read memory registers, I wouldn't have a job at a fucking help desk, okay? I'm not bitter. We had those kinds of things. We had a much softer interface. We had help available, you know, in a static place. And the actual icon would do things like that. Like one of the things that I don't necessarily advocate, but is advocated in user interfaces now, is using careful animation of standard icons that we see everywhere. You know, there's standard iconography that you see in airports, that you see in bus terminals, you know, that you see on highways and things like that, for hotel, for help, for police, for medical emergencies, for fire. And there are simple methods of iconography that we can take from the real world in order to communicate subtle things like that. Like the whole thing about the color scheme in employing security level, and then saying to the users who wanted to know exactly what was going on to be able to have a gradient bar at the bottom to have specific information there to look at, okay, well, what does this shade of blue mean? And have it tell them exactly what that means. You know, and that's the kind of successive disclosure that I think will be a part of future interfaces, and that I do heavily advocate as a user interface designer. By the way, I'd like to thank everybody here for staying. I know user interface design is probably the single least interesting topic at this year's DEF CON, but I just want to thank you for staying. And yeah. Oh, I don't know what the next talk is.
Just so you know, it's not on your schedule, but White Knight's coming up with a good talk on video surveillance on the global scale, and he's knows his shit real good. Right here. Same bat channel, sometime soon.
I think so. I'm sorry. It's a bonus track. All of you guys got to stay. Those of you who actually ate a late lunch. I think you were next in the back there. Oh, could you speak up? I can't hear you. There's a good paper out there that I think Zimmerman may have been a co-author on. I'm not positive about that. It's called Why Johnny Can't Encrypt. No, I'm serious. That's what the paper is called. Type it into Google and you'll be able to find references for it. Look it up in your library. But it's a very, very famous, like, far and away in, I think, 40% of the research that we were doing, that was presented as a resource. And if you want to look into more about that, I mean, that's not something that I'm going to touch with a 10-foot pole. But, I mean, I think that there are ways employing these paradigms that more creative people than I can use. I mean, user interface people are building upon paradigms and crushing paradigms and reaffirming paradigms every day. And I think that these 5 points are enough to build from. You know, this is what my research and what my experience has given me. I think I should can take one more question. Yeah. I hate attachments. No, I hate attachments. That was the bane of my existence in my help desk days. Do I have time for one more? Or? Okay.
You know why, but it's because we taught them this is the way to do their business. It's not because we gave them another option. Here, that's exactly. Most users tend to use what they have available to do their job. And if we don't allow them to make it easier for them, they will do attachments because it gets the job done. Yeah.
Yes, but this is why we have NetWare, and this is why we issue guest accounts to many, many people so that they can go retrieve it for themselves instead of having them crash our mail servers because this person has to send every dissertation that any of his students have ever written.
Yeah, and you're talking about yourself.
Right.
You're not talking about the idiot who just knows how to attach. This is the way to make
No, but that, I mean, that's a real world paradigm that failed. That male attachments. Yeah, yeah, go ahead. Well, no, I'm serious. Like, that's a real-world paradigm that we were very, very ill-prepared for, was the male attachment. I mean, people love male attachments for some... Well, I mean, I understand, because that's the way that they do things. You know, before they put a dissertation in a FedEx package or in a USPS postal envelope and send it off in the mail. Same thing works for email. Well, it should anyway, but it doesn't. And it's a real-world paradigm that failed because we don't have... the technology, we haven't written the protocols to support that kind of massive traffic.
We used to do this with sneaker
net. Right. Right. I mean,
now we just went through electronically and did the same thing, attached it.
No, I mean, that's, I advocate sneaker net. I advocate if, I mean, this one person was sending massive, massive files across campus, and it was still easier to send one of our help desk people with an orb disk, get on their bike, ride up to North Campus or take a bus up to North Campus, with, regardless of how fast our network was, and we had a really fast network, it was always, always easier for them to ship things that way. Sneakernet is still a very, very viable thing. You know, just because we have, you know, 100 megabit networks and fiber and all this doesn't mean we have to use it.
No, but that's what caused the network's faster, so therefore, instead of doing the old sneakernet stuff or doing the floppy disk, now do this nice network and go across here. Now we've expanded to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
We've taught them. It's the IT people. We've taught them how to do this, not the other way around.
The IT people have given the users too much power. I don't think it's necessarily the IT users' fault, but of course, as you know, I'm really, really biased. Are there any other questions? Any other lingering concerns? Yes, you, sir.
You smack them upside the head.
No, but I mean, in all seriousness, that's, I mean, that is why we need better interfaces. For people who just want to get their stuff done, you know, we try to teach them, we try to give them information on how to get stuff done, but just because interfaces are so intimidating on a subconscious level, you know, there are a lot of people that we have to really bash into the pattern and bash in to the kind of rut that we want them to go into when, you know, we want them to finish their jobs. Right, but the answer is not always the same to each question. I'll take this up with you outside. I'm taking time away from White Knight. Thank you very much. And if anybody has any jobs in San Francisco, I have to get out of Michigan.